Hello, I'm Darren Newman, and this is the Range of Reasonable Responses podcast. In this series, I've been going back to employment law cases of the past and trying to see what relevance they have today. And in this episode, I'm going to go all the way back to 1982 and the classic redundancy selection case of Williams against Compare Maxim Limited. Now, despite its age, this case is regularly quoted as the leading case when it comes to handling redundancies. And I was reminded of it most recently when I was looking at the new case from the EAT, a case called Green against the London Borough of Barking and Dagenham. And that case involved someone who was working for a local authority who was made redundant as part of a restructuring exercise. And that involved three posts being deleted and two new posts being created, a very familiar scenario. So the three employees were invited to apply for those two new posts, and Ms. Green, who was the claimant, was unsuccessful. And when she claimed unfair dismissal, the Employment Tribunal looked at the case of Williams against Compare Maxim Limited and said, well, that case really is about the criteria that you use in the and the process that you go through when you're selecting a number of people from a wider group to be made redundant. They said it doesn't really stand up when you're looking at this sort of case, which is much more about a recruitment exercise. In other words, where the employer has redefined jobs and created a vacancy for a new role, but there's too many employees to fill that vacancy, so the employer is essentially recruiting new people into the post. And the tribunal relied on the case of Morgan against Welsh Rugby Union Limited. Now, that's a case from 2011, which said that in that sort of recruitment exercise, Williams against Compare Maxim wasn't particularly useful. And what the EAT said in Green, that's the new case, was that we really shouldn't get too bogged down in the difference between what Williams and Compare Maxim says and what Morgan and Welsh Rugby Union says. What we've always got to concentrate on is the general principle of fairness that we find in Section 98(4) of the Employment Rights Act, where the question is simply whether the employer has behaved reasonably. And that made me go back to Williams against Compare Maxim to see whether what's always quoted as a leading case actually tells us anything that we wouldn't get just by applying the normal principles of fairness. So let's go back to 22nd of January 1982. Margaret Thatcher is Prime Minister. Inflation is 12%. And the UK has just experienced 2 years of recession. At the end of this month, unemployment will reach 3 million for the first time since 1930. Meanwhile, over in Argentina, a certain General Galtieri has just taken power. Let's just say that 1982 will turn out to be a very eventful year. Oh, and the number one hit single is Bucks Fizz, Land of Make-Believe. Make of that what you will. Anyway, Compare Maxim Limited had been having a rough time. During the last quarter of 1980, the company lost £110,000. That's a lot of money in 1980. And in October of that year, they'd asked for voluntary redundancies. They actually had 35 volunteers, but that still wasn't enough. What they were looking at was a need to make a reduction of about 40% of the workforce as a whole. Although they managed to put that off for a while by reaching an agreement with the union on short-term working. But eventually, by the end of 1980, there was a new works manager appointed, and he was told that he just had to get the group's finances in order. And things were so grim that one of the possibilities he considered was total closure of the factory, but instead he decided to go for a complete reorganisation. And what he decided to do was, first of all, reduce the number of managers down to three. And each of those three managers was then required to pick a team for his department so that the key staff were retained in order to keep the company viable. In January 1981, there was a meeting with the union, APEX, that was the Association of Professional, Executive, Clerical and Computer Staff, a union that's since been merged into the GMB, and they agreed that the company would put out a further call for volunteers for redundancy, but this time only seven people came forward. Basically, everyone who was willing to volunteer had already done that. And at that stage, the union expected to be called in for further meetings and further consultations. But what actually happened was the departmental manager simply drew up their list of those that they wanted to keep and those that they decided to make redundant. Now, as a result of the whole exercise, four people eventually brought an unfair dismissal claim, and they were all in one department, which was managed by Mr. Hennessy. And he said that what he did was start from a blank sheet in terms of staffing his department. He drew up a list of vacancies and selected employees from the existing workforce according to who he thought would best suit those vacancies. In his evidence in front of the tribunal, he said that his choice was quite subjective because he basically felt that he'd known all of the people since he joined the company and he was in the best position to choose who would be the best to take the company forward. And the list that he drew up was presented to Apex as a fait accompli. The union was told about the redundancies and the employees themselves were just informed the next day. Now, that's obviously a failure to consult, and there was a separate case brought under what is now Section 188 of the 1992 Trade Union Labour Relations Consolidation Act, and under that claim, employees were eventually given an award of compensation, but that's a whole separate claim, a whole separate issue from the unfair dismissal claims. When it came to those unfair dismissal claims, the tribunal held that the dismissals were actually fair. They took the view that the company was essentially in a survival situation and had to do something drastic. And in that context, it was reasonable to make the selection for redundancy by selecting the employees that the managers regarded as being those who would keep the company viable in the long run. Now, while there was no specific warning of those redundancies, the whole workforce had known for some time that there were problems with the company and that there were going to be redundancies in the future. So in the circumstances, it wasn't necessary to have any further warnings. In any event, they'd all been given 4 weeks' pay in lieu of notice, which gave them some time to look for alternative employment. The employees appealed, and the EAT held that the tribunal's finding was actually perverse. The EAT substituted a finding that the dismissals were unfair. And in doing that, they identified a number of principles that they said, as a matter of good industrial relations, should apply in cases where employees are represented by an independent trade union recognised by the employer. And that takes us to the thing that is quoted time and time again, and which makes Williams against Compare Maxim the leading case on selection for redundancy. Because the EAT comes up with a numbered list of factors. There really is nothing better than a numbered list for getting your case quoted time and time again down the years. So if any EAT judges are listening, that's the secret. Anyway, here are the five factors. 1. The employer will seek to give as much warning as possible of impending redundancies so as to enable the union and the employees to make preparations and suggestions for alternatives. 2. The employer will consult the union as to the best means by which the desired management result can be achieved fairly and with as little hardship to the employees as possible, and in particular, the employer will try to agree with the union the criteria to be applied in selecting the employees to be made redundant. 3. Whether or not the criteria has been agreed with the union, the employer will then seek to establish criteria for selection, which so far as possible do not depend solely on the opinion of the person making the selection and can be objectively checked against such things as attendance record, efficiency at the job, experience and length of service. 4. The employer will seek to ensure that the selection is made fairly in accordance with those criteria and will consider any representations the union may make as to that selection. And 5. The employer will seek to see whether instead of dismissing an employee, you could offer alternative employment. The EAT held that if the tribunal had applied these standards, they would inevitably have found that the dismissals were unfair because that simply wasn't how this company had gone about things. The EAT then goes on to add a word of warning, and they stressed, first of all, that the five principles they'd identified were not immutable rules, which would stay unaltered as practices and attitudes in industry change with time and new norms of acceptable industrial relations behaviour emerge. And secondly, the factors that they were setting out were not principles of law, but standards of behaviour. So in future cases before the EAT, there should be no attempt to say that an industrial tribunal, which is what they were called then, which did not have regard to or give effect to one of those factors, had misdirected itself in law. It was only in cases where there was a genuine case of perversity on the grounds that the decision flew in the face of common accepted standards of fairness that those factors would be directly relevant. I wonder how the EAT would have felt if they knew that the five principles that they'd set out on that quite limited basis would be quoted time and time again for the next 35 years. And of course, although they are quoted time and time again, the EAT is right, or was right, in the sense that standards have changed over the years. When I was first writing about employment law back in the 1990s, the standard model for making people redundant was that the employer would use a matrix. And on the matrix, they would set out the various criteria that they had decided on, and employees would be scored against those criteria. The scores would then be added up, and the employees would be ranked depending on the numbers to be made redundant, and that would give you a relegation zone. It was from that relegation zone that employees would be selected for redundancy. What seems to be increasingly likely to happen nowadays, particularly in the public sector, but large private sector organisations too, is that the entire redundancy exercise is run as though the employer is actually recruiting people. So the employer identifies the roles that it needs for the future, and it invites its employees to apply for those roles and actually makes the selection on the basis of a job interview. Now, in Morgan against Welsh Rugby Union, that 2011 case that I mentioned at the beginning, the EAT said that Williams and Compare Maxim didn't really have much application to that sort of exercise. But of course, what we've just seen is that that is essentially how the redundancy in Williams and Compare Maxim was run. The managers were choosing the people that they wanted going forward. They created the vacancies and they selected the people who would fill those vacancies. And what made the dismissals unfair, particularly if you set aside the things that were specific to the recognition of a trade union, what made the dismissals unfair was that the managers in question simply picked their favourite people. They picked the ones that they thought would be the best, that they had no external criteria that they could say they were applying. They were just picking their favourites. So they couldn't explain how the particular decisions had been reached. And I often say that one of the golden rules of employment law is that whatever decision you're making as an employer, you should be able to explain how that decision was made and why it was made. That's certainly true when it comes to redundancy. Now, a confession, I frankly don't like selections for redundancy by recruitment interview. I think that there are dangers, in particular that the employer might lose sight of what it is they're actually doing, which is sacking people, not recruiting people. But I have to acknowledge that by the industrial relations standards of today, it's a perfectly acceptable way of running a redundancy exercise because, frankly, it's done by a huge range of employers every day. Of course, what matters is whether overall the process adopted by the employer is a reasonable one. And we shouldn't get too bogged down in a specific test set out by an employment appeal tribunal more than 30 years ago. Much of what Williams and Compare Maxim said really does only apply when you're talking about selecting people in the context of a recognised union environment. But I think that the key lesson of Williams and Compare Maxim that I think is as important today as it was in 1982 is that the employer needs to have clear criteria for the decision it's making. You can't have the decision being made on the subjective whim of the manager. It's not good enough to say, I'm sorry, you just didn't come across very well in that interview, or you just weren't successful this time, there were many excellent candidates and somebody else just won through. That sort of thing is fine for an actual recruitment exercise, but it isn't a fair basis on which to sack somebody. You need to be able to explain why the selection was made and show that the basis on which it was made was based on some sort of proper criteria. You need to show how it relates to criteria that you've set out in advance. Now, you're not obliged to do that in a recruitment process, but surely we can expect employers to do that when they're deciding to dismiss. Well, that's enough preaching from me. Join me again soon for some more classic employment law cases from the archives. In the meantime, if you like this sort of thing, you can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or directly on the blog. Also, follow my written blog at the Range of Reasonable Responses, and you can always find me on Twitter. I'm at Daz Newman. Thanks for listening.